This is your award-winning BCFM. BCFM on 93.2, 24 hours a day.
Perfect government is coming soon, and I'm looking forward to it.
Mystery Babylon, the secret societies, Freemason, the Knights Templars, the Knights of Malta, the ancient order of the Rose and Cross, the age-old dream of a perfect government, permanent utopia up on this earth. Secret revolutionary groups working toward a takeover of the world.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. The Sheriff of Nottingham steals from the poor again, but where was Robin Hood, Shadow Chancellor John McDonnell? Was he asleep on the job? This week was George Osborne's sixth budget, and like the rest, it's taken from the poor and given to the rich. This time specifically from the disabled to big business. Is this what government's for? What about the inevitable crash the former governor of the Bank of England has warned of in his new book? Was anything done to claw back money squirrelled away in tax havens by super-rich donors to the Conservative Party and others? We speak to tax justice expert and chartered accountant Richard Murphy. And with hundreds of thousands of untaxed acres, one of the country's biggest and oldest landowners, the tax-havened up Tory Duke of Buccleuch, now wants to charge us peasants in his Dalkeith mansion area £10 to walk in the country park that used to be free. Thankfully, though, it all could be illegal. Also, the privacy shield. Have the tech giants like Google and Microsoft been breaching our human rights for decades? Will the bosses Eric Schmidt and Bill Gates go to jail for 9 years of breaking the law? I doubt it. And Libya. Do we have troops in there now or not? And if so, why, like Yemen, has Parliament not been asked? Plus, Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots. But we start this week with the budget and with Richard Murphy, I hope, is joining me on the line now. Hi, Richard. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Would you like to just take us through your take on Wednesday's budget and what you think the real headline figures and points are?
It was a fascinating budget because it was so difficult to work out what George Osborne was really trying to do. He is in a mess. The world is undoubtedly much more difficult than he tried to pretend it was last autumn. He undoubtedly is going to get less money in than he expected, and that's because, first of all, the UK economy isn't as big as he expected, and secondly, therefore, we aren't going to be paying as much tax, and thirdly, as a consequence, he's expecting to spend more because many of the things that the government spends are dependent upon the state of growth, and if growth falls, then there are more benefit claims, there are more other costs proportionate to income. For example, pensions go up even though growth may be static. So he's facing the situation he can't really balance his books. He's admitted he's broken his welfare cap and will every year. He's broken his borrowing rule already because he borrowed more in the current year than it was forecast he would and more than he borrowed last year, which is a record reversal. We didn't expect to see that, but he's actually borrowing more when he said he would always borrow less. And he's got one rule left, which he wants to keep intact, which is that he will balance the books by 2020. Well, I'll let the listeners into a secret. He has no hope whatsoever of doing that, technically, and actually it is beyond his ability to achieve that now, but he's still trying to pretend it is. So this was a budget full of lots of numbers, which candidly every economist I've spoken to, from left or right, and I admit that I'm generally seen as being on the left, but I have had plenty of discussions with those on the right, say he just can't achieve this. So we have a budget which, frankly, it's a bit like, well, a made up set of numbers.
That's a bit worrying for the national economy. Also, I mean, I was looking up recently a previous Chancellor of the Exchequer, Francis Dashwood, who was part of the Hellfire Club down in High Wycombe, and he was Chancellor of the Exchequer for, I think it was about a year and a half, but there was a real rage in the press at the time against him. This, I think, is in the 1700s. Or early 1800s, and he was only allowed in for to be Chancellor for about a year and a half. He made such a mess of things, he was booted out by popular opinion and by the press, effectively. I wonder what you thought of the press coverage of this budget on Wednesday. I know my thinking was that a lot of the major points, for example, Mervyn King saying that another crash was inevitable, were not even covered as part of the mainstream media coverage of the budget on Wednesday.
Yeah, we have a real problem. I mean, the press focuses upon all the things that I've just ignored in my commentary, and almost deliberately I ignored all the little things about taxation. I also ignored, of course, all the provisions with regard to disability benefits, which look as though they're going to really unravel for him. The press is dominated in its approach by what, as an economist, I would call the microeconomic bits of the budget. That is, how does it pan out for each household? So the little tax changes, and actually in this budget they are little, although overall they are going to benefit the best off, and they're going to be more harmful to those least well off. That was perhaps almost inevitable, but it was quite clear that that was the case. So we get a lot of reaction dominated by the commentary from the Institute for Fiscal Studies, who clearly lead the field in this area, which is very much focused upon these small individual household-focused changes. Now, some of these household changes, like those for people on disability, the 370,000 people on disability benefits of various sorts who are going to lose out up to £3,500 a year, this is a catastrophic budget, and so it's right to focus on this sort of issue for them. Frankly, capital gains tax, which has attracted a lot of attention, significant for the country's tax avoiders who will be rubbing their hands with glee, as will many accountants, but it does miss that big issue, like the fact that Mervyn King is saying we could be facing a global economic crisis. The central bankers of the world are saying to governments, including that of the UK...
Sorry, Richard, sorry to interrupt you, but he actually used the word crash. And we've got a clip coming up in a little while from the interview he did on the Andrew Marr show, where Andrew Marr said, talks about it as the great crash of 2008. But of course, it was a bailout that actually stopped a Great Depression-style crash. So I wonder if you're with me or with Andrew Marr on the terminology to describe what happened in 2008 and what could happen that Mervyn King's describing as a crash.
Oh, well, look, I think 2008 was a crash. I mean, what crashed? Government revenues crashed. What failed? The banks. What was the consequence? A massive fall in the capacity of this country to make enough money to apparently make our ends meet. Now, I don't agree with that final conclusion entirely, but that's what it looks like. So, yes, it was a crash. It was a fundamental change in the way we viewed our economy. What appeared to be working before 2008 wasn't after 2008. The real question now is, do we face another one? Have we actually got ourselves back to a position where we understand the economy well enough in this new environment to stop a crash happening again? I'm afraid the sorry answer to that is no, in my opinion. We haven't put the banks right. We're still too dependent on financial services. We haven't begun to address the issues like the balance of trade, which is still incredibly poor. We have still got too much saving in our economy, and yet George Osborne was encouraging more of it. And actually, you know, most people think, oh, but saving is good, surely. Well, no, it isn't, because we are desperately short of demand in the UK economy, which is why people's wages aren't going up, which is why people, there are not enough well-paid jobs in the economy, which is why we're not lifting out of, you know, almost static period with regard to growth for most people. I mean, we do have apparent growth, but a lot of that is down to house price increases, down to large companies making more profits, but not necessarily ordinary people listening to this program seeing their position improve. So we are in a position where we're very, very weak and vulnerable still. And Mervyn King is right to warn that we could have another crash. I think we are at significant risk of that. And that is why, actually, last summer, Jeremy Corbyn borrowed one of my ideas. I didn't write it for him, which is something called people's quantitative easing, which would be a way of the government bailing out the economy next time, but not by giving money to banks, but this time actually spending it on things that we need in the economy, hospitals, schools, houses, most particularly. Let's have more houses. But also green energy, long-term infrastructure, things like that, broadband for rural communities, all essential to actually meet one of the objectives which George Osborne talked about but did nothing to fulfill, which was providing an economy fit for the next generation.
But Richard, we're already doing quantitative easing.
No. Very different. Totally different. Old-style quantitative easing, £375 billion of money printed by the Bank of England out of thin air, used to buy back government debt, was money given to our banks. In effect, they didn't use it. They speculated some of it. They certainly took some big bankers' bonuses out of it. But most of that money is now sitting back on deposit in the Bank of England. It's done nothing productive, but it did boost the banks' balance sheets. So they are at least solvent at the moment. Next time, something fundamentally different. Yes, create new government debt, but buy it back from the Bank of England, but then use the newly printed money to literally go out into the economy and say, we are going to create jobs, building houses, installing green energy systems. Bristol is one of the places which really wants to be a leader in green energy. I think a load of this money should come to Bristol for that reason. I'm well aware of your ambitions on this. Putting it to work in every constituency in the UK, this is so different from the version we had before that perhaps I shouldn't have used the same name.
What's been the actual effect of this QE from the Eurozone and from the US then? You're saying effectively it's just gone kind of around in a giant circle.
A lot of it has gone around in a giant circle, I'm afraid. That's exactly right. It has boosted share prices. It has boosted house prices in the southeast of England. It did for a while boost oil and commodity prices, although that effect has all gone away now, which is why we've now seen the reverse coming into play. But for a while, it certainly did boost those prices as well. But fundamentally, it has been kept entirely within the financial system. That is not what the people who proposed this conventional QE, if I can call it that, quantitative easing, expected to happen. But it's why in September 2010, I actually wrote the first version of what is now called people's quantitative easing, which was to say, look, I don't think it's going to work in finance. The money is not going to get out into the real economy. It's not going to benefit real people. It is only going to benefit the very best off, who will see their asset worth increase significantly. And that, by the way, has happened. So we have greater inequality in this country as a result of QE. And instead, we need to actually make sure it promotes the increase in real wages. This should be, in my opinion, the target for the Bank of England now. What we have seen over the last couple of decades is a significant shift in the UK economy, where the amount of profit and the amount of rent in the economy has gone up, and the share of total income of wages has gone down. And I want that to be redressed. I want people who work for a living to get a greater share of growth. And if they do, they will spend more money, and that will create a virtuous circle where we create more demand, we pay more tax, and amazingly, of course, as a result, we'll have fewer people on benefits, and the government can balance its books. Since the 1930s, we have known that the only way to solve a downturn or to solve a period of long-term flat economy is to spend. Somebody's got to break the cycle of stagnation. And the only organization that can do that is the government. So it is down to the government now to break this pattern. But the understanding, it's widespread, and the central bankers are even now saying it is government must spend to do this. Spending on investment, as I say, on housing, on schools, on broadband, on green energy and so on, all all of that has the highest impact, the greatest rate of return. That's why the central bankers are begging governments to do it, because it pays for itself, because it promotes so much growth that tax, a lot of tax, is paid as a consequence because people are put to work and therefore the cost is recovered. And in fact, you move into a period of growth where you then balance the books. But what George Osborne is doing at the moment is saying, no, I'm going to cut the economy and cut it again, claiming that he's running it as if it's a household. But he's like somebody who's running a household who's saying, well, we've got to make sure we balance the books. And the thing he's cut out is the spending on bus fares that lets the country get to work, to earn an income, to actually pay any of the costs it incurs. He's literally making it impossible for us to earn enough to ever balance the books.
Well, one of the major problems really since the Thatcher era has been that it's been increasingly easy for the rich to squirrel their wealth away abroad. In fact, I think it was Ian Cameron, am I right? Maybe David Cameron's father that actually set up one of the first, after Margaret Thatcher released exchange controls in 1980, I think, one of the first companies that would help people manage their wealth out of the country and out from the grasp of the tax man. So I wonder if you think that this budget has done anything to claw back some of the money which is being put taken abroad to places like the Maldives and goodness knows where else, so that the taxman can't get their hands on that wealth.
Well, let's come a little closer to home. Jersey, Guernsey and the Isle of Man are all tax havens. No, the Chancellor did very little about this. There was only one headline measure, which was targeted entirely at large companies who are trying to shift some of their income offshore. It's a sort of a bit of a swipe at maybe the Starbucks-style schemes that were in the headlines 2 or 3 years ago. I was involved with many of those stories. I've been campaigning on this issue for a long time. So there was one change which was welcome, to stop companies making payments of royalties tax-free to tax havens. Otherwise, there was very little in this government in this budget for that. The big measure, which would have really changed large company behaviour, would have been if George Osborne had announced that he was going to require what's called country-by-country reporting by multinational companies on public record. What this means is they have to publish an income statement, a profit and loss account, if you like, for every country where they operate, without exception, including the Cayman Islands, including the British Virgin Islands, and Jersey, and Guernsey, and so on, and show us how much money they are really squirreling away.
But hang on a minute, Richard, because surely the people like the Swiss wouldn't like that. They like to have, and one of they're known for secrecy, for example, that they would be very happy for these companies to declare to the Swiss government and to the Swiss taxman what they're earning and paying and their balance sheet in Switzerland, but not elsewhere, maybe.
Well, I'm entirely biased about country-by-country reporting because, I will be honest with you, I thought the whole thing up in 2003. I never expected it to become something which was on the international agenda, but in 2014 it was adopted as a new standard for all tax authorities by the OECD, which sets the world rules for taxation. The UK has adopted it into law for tax purposes, but not for public consumption. Apparently, we can't be trusted with it. We can't see this information, but tax authorities.
So you're saying HMRC can see this, but the public aren't allowed to see it?
Yeah. They are now going to see these accounts, but we're not allowed to.
Because HMRC themselves have come under a lot of criticism, haven't they? Focusing on, for example, small businesses and the self-employed and not the big corporations.
Well, I entirely agree with the criticism of HMRC. I'm certainly one of the big critics of what they do. I think they fail to hold large companies to account. I think they've appeared far too often before the Public Accounts Committee, having to apologise for their own failings. I don't think it's good enough that this information only goes to them. I think we do need this on public record, because then the large companies, and I do actually speak to these large companies quite often, will be embarrassed into changing their behaviour, and they would change their behaviour. Nothing would be more effective, and we had not a hint of it from George Osborne, even though he says he thinks it's a good idea. Now, actually, this is one of those things where the European Union might deliver what the UK may be refusing. It does look as though it is possible the EU will require this soon. If they do, then actually we will get change which will stop large companies abusing these places and increase potentially the amount of tax paid here. That would be good news. I'm not saying saying this is a reason for voting stay in or out. I'm saying this is one of the areas where they do regulate things quite well. It looks like they've heard the demand.
Can you give us a few headlines, Richard, about the you know, some of your proposals to, if you were been sitting in George Osborne's shoes, what you would have done to try and stop this tax avoidance and tax evasion? Because some of it is criminal tax evasion. It's just that we don't have the actual evidence to take people to court, and sometimes there's not the will, the political will, to take, for example, Tory donors to court. But what needs to change to stop the super rich keeping their money abroad and keeping it out of the reach of the tax man?
Super rich are causing us losses. I'm afraid to say quite a lot are actually small businesses putting cash in their pockets in the UK too. So, I mean, I would not just look at the super rich. What would I do? Look, we are definitely making some progress. So, for example, HM Revenue and Customs are going to get this data soon. But we've got no indication that they're going to recruit extra staff to deal with it. So the first thing I would be doing if I was George Osborne, or if I had been John McDonnell, replying to this, and I have spoken to John McDonnell this week, I would be saying, please, let's have more staff in HM Revenue and Customs to actually address the issue. There's a lot of evidence that at this level, the very high level, the very, you know, where we're dealing with very big taxpayers, for every £1 we spend on a tax inspector, we get back up to £15 in extra tax. And yet we know that the government is still planning to cut the size of HM Revenue and Customs. It's completely bizarre that at the time when we are short of government income, when we need to balance the books, or we're told we need to balance the books, I question whether we need to necessarily, because I think we can afford a deficit of a reasonable amount, but when we're told we need to balance the books, we're not recruiting the people who can raise the money to do, achieve that goal. So number one is we need lots of people, highly skilled people, paid decent salaries, some of whom will actually be poachers turned gamekeepers, who will be out there challenging these large companies, these individuals, and using the new data we're going to get. That is perhaps the most important thing that we can do of all. The second thing that we need to do with regard to this is actually look at the banks themselves. Because if you go to a tax haven, and I do, you'll find that if you walk down the high streets and have a look at who the banks are, many of the names will be familiar to you because they're the same names as you'll see on a UK high street. So we need to decide whether we're being really serious about challenging the activities of our banks operating in these places. Thirdly, we need to actually insist that all the tax havens that are ours, and by that I mean Jersey, Guernsey, the Isle of Man, the Cayman Islands, Gibraltar, the British Virgin Islands, and others, Bermuda, for example, all of those with the Queen's head on their stamps and on their notes and coins, all of them effectively protected by the UK, all of them enjoying what are in effect British passports because they're not independent countries, all of those places should frankly be told, look, you're undermining the tax revenues of the UK and other countries. We are not putting up with this anymore. We are going to insist that you are open and accountable and transparent. The secrecy which lets the abuse go on has to disappear for good. Accounts must be on public record. Who owns companies must be on public record. This would, by and large, end a lot of the abuse because nobody wants to be seen to be a tax cheat. And at the moment, the tax havens make sure they can't be seen. If we could see who was doing it, a lot of people would stop overnight. So those are my top three measures that I would take to deal with this. I could keep going all night and tell you some more, but I'm sure you don't want to carry on forever.
The Cayman Islands, for example, you're saying they're undermining the tax revenue of the UK, but aren't they UK protectorates? I just wonder, isn't there something completely, a bit of a no-brainer about this, that if these places are British protectorates, or the British have some kind of power over there, what are they doing allowing them to undermine Britain's own tax receipt policy? What is going on?
Well, there was a very interesting programme on the BBC a few weeks ago, a documentary on the Cayman Islands in particular. And the interviewer went to see the governor of the Cayman Islands, who's a British Crown appointment, the representative of the Queen. And the interviewer also went to see the Prime Minister of the Cayman Islands, and he asked them the the Prime Minister, locally elected, said, oh yes, Britain could stop it at any time it liked. Now, one of those two was telling a lie. And I suggest it was the governor. I believe we could close these places down if we wanted to. I can tell you why, in the case of the Cayman Islands, its constitution is actually a statutory instrument. That means effectively a piece of UK legislation passed by the UK House of Commons. That shows how intimately related it is to the UK. Literally, its laws eventually require rubber stamping in this country by the Privy Council, which is, of course, in practice, our government. So, you know, they are really, for all functional purposes, part of the UK. We play this silly game, which starts from the special role that the City of London has in the UK economy, dating right back to Magna Carta, where it has its own rights with regard to taxation. For 800 years, we basically said the City of London is sort of outside the tax system. Well, all these places are branch offices of the City of London, which can fairly be said to be a tax haven in its own right. And whilst we won't take on the abuses in the city, these places carry on. It needs a tough Chancellor, a tough Prime Minister, to turn around and say, no, enough is enough. If necessary, we'll provide them with some bailout money to let them transition to a different type of economy, but they've got to stop the abuse.
But you've just said, surely, that this is a Crown appointment. The Chancellor, the Treasury, can't decide who's the Governor of the Cayman Islands.
Oh, yeah, look, the Crown appointment means the Queen, but in practice, the Queen never appoints anyone. It's always nominated by the Prime Minister.
Okay. We were talking about QE earlier and about the whole sort of money system, taking it right back to how money's created. I wonder if you think that there's been a big difference in the way that the economy's managed since we've gone away from money that's actually backed by something of real value. I think that this was back in the 1970s. Nixon took the dollar, for example, off of gold because he needed more money to pay for the Vietnam War. And does it really make any difference if money is backed by something substantial so that you can go to the bank and say, actually, I want my little piece of silver or piece of gold in exchange for this money I've got?
Oh, look, the gold standard was an absolute disaster for the UK. The last person who tried to keep us on the gold standard was, in fact, Winston Churchill. He put us back on it in 1925 after the Second World War. And for those who know their history, 1926 was the general strike because everything was going disastrously wrong. By 1929, we had the biggest recession we'd ever seen until 2008. The gold standard basically means that we are guaranteed to have a limited amount of money in the economy. That's a disaster. We actually need enough money in the economy to let all of us actually undertake the transactions we want so that we can earn at the level which we're capable of. To fix that to something as arbitrary as gold is just ludicrous. It would guarantee a crash at the moment because there's a fixed amount of gold, and we, as a growing country, and we are a growing country in terms of numbers of people, and we should be a growing country in terms of our national income, need our money supply to increase to meet that demand, and therefore we have to create money, which is literally printed. If you want to know what the national debt looks like, by the way, simply get a £10 note out of your wallet or purse now, have a look at it. That's what the national debt looks like. I would also suggest to anybody...
Sorry, can you just explain what you mean by that?
Look, every single note and every single coin in circulation in the UK is owed by the Bank of England, which is owned by the government. They are not different. They are one and the same. The Bank of England is part of the government. It's owed by the Bank of England to you, who has that note in their hand. How do I know it's owed? Because it says, I promise to pay. That's a debt. And quite literally, all money is debt. You can never have money which is anything else. All money represents a value of a debt that you owe to somebody. So, if you're paid at the end of the month by your employer, they have paid a debt to you. You've now got money that you can swap their debt to you for somebody else with somebody else to buy something. And the way in which money works is that we swap debts between each other. Well, pound coins, £10 notes are all just debt. Over £60 billion of the UK's national debt, which politicians say is £1.5 trillion, but actually is £375 billion. yourself that money, and you don't owe a debt to yourself. It's absolutely impossible. But whether it's £1.5 trillion or £1.1 trillion, all that the national debt is effectively the backup to the money system in the UK. If we actually got rid of the national debt, there would be no money left in this country.
Interesting.
And therefore, we actually couldn't run the economy. There would literally be no notes and coins, nothing.
But I wonder if you think maybe it's gone too much the other way, where the pieces of paper that are circulating as money, the dits on our bank accounts, etc., aren't actually backed by anything. They're just a matter of faith. They're a matter of faith in the system, which looks like it's pretty creaky.
Well, look, they're backed by the government's promise at the end of the day. The government's promise will back the vast majority of listeners' bank accounts, because they will have, I can't remember what the limit of the money bank guarantee by the bank at the moment is, by the government is. I think it's about £60,000 or £70,000 if you've got in a bank account. That would make you one of the richer people in the country if you've even got that amount of money in a bank account. That's guaranteed by the government. It is the government's promise to pay that keeps the UK economy going. And its promise to pay is backed by the fact that if push comes to shove, it will print some more money, so everything will be paid. Now, we don't want to print too much money. We would eventually get inflation. But printing £375 billion of quantitative easing from 2009 to 2012 has now delivered us no inflation at all. Actually, inflation is quite a good thing for most people. Pensioners are protected from inflation. We know that. So most pensioners do have some protection. The rest of society, I admit, doesn't. But we need inflation, because without inflation, businesses don't invest. People put off their spending, and we end up with a sluggish economy where there aren't enough jobs, where the world is actually not moving fast enough to keep everybody as busy as they should be. Incomes are in short supply. The government has a shortage of tax revenue, and we end up in the sort of situation we're in. So we actually need to print more money at the moment to keep our economy going round. We're short of cash. We could create it at no cost, well, almost no cost. It does cost a penny or two to print a £20 note, but that's about it. We could create this money. We could have it. We could invest it. We could put people to work. We could create a bit of that inflation we need without creating any danger to the economy, in fact, making it a safer place than it is at present. I am completely baffled. I genuinely am completely baffled why our politicians won't say this when so many economists know this to be true.
Hello there, Richard. My name's Martin Summers. I'm on the show fairly regularly, and I agree with everything you've said so far. Although I would ask you a question. What do you think of this whole idea of the positive money people, that's the creation of debt-based finance is a problem, and that the government has it in its power to create money without creating debt at the same time? I'd be interested to hear what your views are on that. I mean, obviously, if you're not going to do that, what you're suggesting is correct, that if debt-based money is inevitable, the government can create debt-based money. But is it possible, as Andy Hayman, I think, from the Bank of England suggested, that it would be possible, it could be possible, for the government to create money underpinning the system, which would not be tied to gold or anything like that, but would actually not be debt-based in its fundamental characteristics?
I have to admit I have a real problem with the idea that positive money put forward. We're going to get pretty technical here. I don't know how you can have money which is not debt-based, because the only reason why we accept that this piece of paper is of any worth is because somebody has promised to accept it. If there is no promise, and the promise is based upon debt, the government's debt, if there is no promise to pay, which is implicit in it, then I think that actually we end up with potentially too much money. Positive money seem to have this opinion that you can create a great big pile of sort of £20 notes out of nothing. But that's not true. There are two ways we make money. One is literally physically printing. The other one is by lending. And we haven't got another way. Now, we don't need more than about 3% of all the money in the economy to be physical notes. The rest is actually entries in bank statements. And every single pound that is in a bank statement is created by lending. If you go into a bank and say you want to go and borrow, I don't know, £10,000 to buy a new car, let's assume it's a bank you haven't got an account with already, and they decide that you're credit worthy, they don't go and check in the vault if they've got £10,000. Let me assure you, they don't do that. What they do instead is simply open you a loan account, and they open you a current account. And for these purposes, we'll say that one of the numbers they put in one account, the loan account, is negative £10,000 as far as you're concerned, because you owe it to them, so it's a negative from your point of view, and they put £10,000 positive in the other account, the current account, so you can go out and buy the car. The world accepts a check drawn on that bank because the world knows that that bank is good, and if you've got a check account on it, then you're probably good for the money. But remember that £10,000 negative that they created for you and £10,000 positive adds together to nothing. In other words, money is made out of thin air. They literally, by entering the two figures in a computer, created £10,000 of money. Now, I think that's value because you've promised to pay the bank. Your promise to pay created the value in that money. But if you just physically keep on printing more money, which is the positive money idea, there's no debt element to it, nobody's promising to pay, and I fear we'll end up with a pile of valueless notes, and we could end up with serious inflation. I'm quite worried about that. There's also the risk that banks may not be able to create enough credit to keep the economy going. And suppose we see an economic upturn, we will see small businesses suddenly demanding a lot of borrowing. They will suddenly want to borrow money to invest. Suppose we decided that we're only going to print £200 million worth of notes this year, and the demand is for £400 million, all those small businesses will be denied the chance to invest because there won't be enough money for them to do it. That would be desperately dangerous for the economy. So we do need the flexibility that money created on the basis of the borrow, the promise to pay, creates. It is the only way we have valuable money.
Richard, we're going to skip over Mervyn King's explaining why the 2008 crisis, the problems that caused it, haven't been fixed. I think that's pretty much taken as read. But one of the things that Andrew Marr did ask Mervyn King about was this idea about who's really in charge. Is it the bankers or the political leaders? So let's have a listen to that now.
I want banks like motorists to take out insurance before they go on the road. Okay. And the whole point about that is that if you decide to drive a bigger and more dangerous, faster car, you pay a higher insurance premium. Mm. You don't need to ban people from driving certain cars. And that flexibility, I think, is one of the key points of the book. To come back to the question of leadership, I think, and politicians, it is very difficult for countries, in the end, to work for each other. I've been to every G20 meeting until I left the bank. And frankly, most of the people there were looking at their home constituencies and domestic political considerations, not really facing up to the major challenges. But there was a problem before the crisis, and I suspect it hasn't gone away, that the large financial institutions had an influence. It wasn't crude in the sense of, you know, bribing people in any shape or form. I'm sure there are some countries around the world where that's true, not here. But first of all, politicians depend on finance and funding, and you can see clearly in the United States how much they depend on financial institutions to pay for their campaigns. And
yeah,
here,
too close.
And here people were rather captured by the apparent success. Everything was going very well.
They were starry-eyed.
They were starry-eyed because this was a sector that appeared to be making ever bigger profits. And the big question you should always ask when someone's making a lot of money is, so what risks are they taking?
That's Mervyn King there speaking to Andrew Marr a week or so ago on the Andrew Marr Show. Richard, I wonder what you make of this, the leadership, the political leadership question as to who's really running things, because often the politicians have to go cap in hand to the city, cap in hand to the bankers, and beg them really on the bended knee, saying, look, we need a little bit more money, please.
Well, one of the big problems we have is that we pretend that the Bank of England is entirely independent of control by the government, and that puts it outside democratic control. And as somebody who thinks their vote matters, and I definitely do think my vote should matter, it worries me no end that we have a governor of the Bank of England who has an enormous amount of power, as Mervyn King did, as Mark Carney now has, to decide what happens in the economy without any political accountability. So the first problem is actually, in my opinion, bringing clear that the bankers are not in charge and the City of London is not the centre of control of the UK economy, which is the impression we give now. I raised this point last summer. It created horror in the Financial Times that I suggested that the Bank of England should be subject to government control. And I actually pointed out, not very quietly, to those who were howling in protest, that if they went to bother to read the 1998 Bank of England Act, Section 19, I'm sorry I'm boring enough to know it, it says that actually the Bank of England operates with the discretion of the Chancellor of the Exchequer. In other words, if the Chancellor of the Exchequer doesn't really like what the Bank of England does at any time, it can be overruled. So we're playing a big game of smoke and mirrors here. Why are we letting it be seen that the bankers are in charge when in practice they may not be in charge? Why are we pretending that the Bank of England has control of monetary policy when clearly they don't? Why are we granting these banks licenses to operate which make it look as though they can run rings around us when we could change the terms of reference? And let's also be clear, they won't run away to anywhere else, even if we do change these terms of reference, because they now know, just as HSBC did, which is why it didn't go to Hong Kong, they now know they need a country as big as and as reliable as the UK in which they can operate in case another crash happens, because actually we saved all the bankers and we saved all their shareholders. Oh, and we also saved everybody who had money in a bank account from financial disaster in 2008. And that's all banks. That's not just the ones that were directly bailed out. Because if any of the ones which were not directly bailed out had not enjoyed the benefit of RBS and Lloyds and Bradford and Bingley and Northern Rock and Salt being bailed out, then they would have failed too, because they all owe each other money. It's a system. It's not individual banks. So it's about time we actually just told the truth. The Bank of England is not independent, and the bankers only operate because we grant them a license to do so. We've done that since 1844, when we've regulated banks since then. It's now time to really say, yeah, we not only regulate them, but we do expect them to comply. But too many people have been too frightened, and it's because of the power we've given them to basically influence the national agenda.
One of the things I saw in the budget, hardly been mentioned, is the it looks like that they're going to not be prosecuting banks for foreign exchange fraud.
They've basically given up the investigation of that. It's a light-touch regime. I think you can safely say...
But look, Richard, hang on, because if you or I commit fraud, we expect to be prosecuted. How come these people can do massive fraud on an international scale and then still walk the streets?
Look, I am perpetually surprised by this. There are a whole load of people in the financial services community who've got away with something little short of, well, not murder, but certainly taking massive financial risk at our expense. I mean, I would have all the big four firms of accountants up in front of the dock. You know, in 2008, all the banks were under massive financial stress at risk of failing, and not a single one of their accounts indicated that there was any problem in them. Single set of accounts in 2007 of a bank was wrong, but no set of accountants has been drawn, you know, has been in any way penalised.
But Richard, this is criminality. It's almost as if there's a criminal elite at work in the
city.
Well,
there is a criminal elite in the sense at work here. It is believed that they are above the law because they are so big they cannot fail. Now, my answer to that is that when I wrote it in 2008, I knew pretty intimately what was happening in the Treasury in 2008. I was sort of aware what was going on. And I felt at the time that if there was any industry that needed to be nationalised, it was banking. But the way I would have nationalised it was a bit like the rail network. I would have taken the banking infrastructure, that's all the payment mechanisms, all actually the account management structures into national ownership.
So you're talking about cash points, things like that?
Well, everything which actually lets the system work. Rather like Network Rail owns all the track of the rail system. Everything that actually lets it work. And then the train operating companies run on top of this infrastructure which is maintained by a state-owned company. Well, I'd have the banks operate on top of this. So you would have an account still with Barclays or HSBC, Santander, whoever it might be. But they would have to pay for use of the infrastructure. In other words, you couldn't lose. And the system would keep going. But in 2008, what they knew was that if they were going to go bust, and let's be clear, RBS did effectively go very badly bust in 2008, they knew that, frankly, Alastair Darling, who was the Chancellor then, had no choice but bail them out, because he faced the risk that if he hadn't, on a Monday morning, there would have been something like 15 to 20% of all the households in the UK who would not have been able to put a payment card into a cash point machine or into a PIN machine at the supermarket and buy the food they needed. On average, there are only 9 meals in the average household in the UK before they run out of food. At most, you've got 9 meals in your store cupboard. After 3 days, by the Wednesday evening, he would have faced millions of mums who couldn't have fed their children. That's a prospect that no chancellor can even think about.
But isn't it rather like having a suicide bomber in the room saying, yes, well, you better do this, otherwise we're going to blow ourselves up?
But what we've got to do is take away their opportunity to basically wear the bomb belt. I think that's probably a bit exaggerated. The sense is they cannot hold us to ransom again, because the infrastructure of banking must belong to us. They must just be able to operate on top of it. If they fail, the whole system does not crash at the same time. Then they couldn't hold us to ransom. But at the present, because we've only got a few big banks, we've only got a few big auditors, we've only got a few big insurance companies, any one of them is too big to fail. They know that. We haven't addressed that fundamental problem. We haven't broken up the banks. We haven't created regional banks. We haven't created an infrastructure bank. We haven't created new firms of auditors. We haven't spread the risk within the pension industry. And as a consequence, we are just as vulnerable now as we were in 2008. And that's why Mervyn King is right to be worried about the system. And he bears responsibility for part of this as well, I should add.
Also, we've heard news this week of the merger, although actually on paper looks much more like a takeover of the London Stock Exchange by the German Börse. Mm. Now, I noticed also the boss of the Deutsche Börse is the former boss of the guy that went down for LIBOR fraud, is Tom Hayes. His boss at UBS is now the chief of the German Börse, and at part of his trial he handed over a booklet which his boss had given him at UBS in Switzerland, how to fix the LIBOR rate. So you do wonder, don't you, as to whether actually it's some of the people who are taking over the London Stock Exchange that should be in the dock as soon as they arrive in London.
Well, the question in terms of financial regulation, and I am, as a chartered accountant, I'm still a financially regulated person, so I know something about this, is are they fit and proper people to run a financial services business? And again, we've seen very, very few people being barred from running any form of financial services organisation as a result of this. It's staggering how when people are blocked from working in the financial services industry, they always seem to have worked for small businesses but never for large ones. The system does appear to be rigged, and I can't say otherwise. If that's the way it looks to me, I think we need to change that, because there is what is called moral hazard in the current system. Moral hazard means that they know they are beyond being put to blame for anything going wrong, so they can take risks that the rest of us could not, and we've seen the price of that.
Well, Roberto Saviano, in his book 000, said that actually the global financial system, in fact many big companies too, is modelling itself on the narco cartels, because they get away with criminality, and actually that's increasingly becoming the way for big business and the financial services industry to survive, is by becoming criminals and doing things that the other ones don't dare to do. Actually makes you bigger and makes you stronger. But anyway, I'd just like to bring Kevin Cahill in, who's sitting in the studio here. Kevin's the author of Who Owns Britain, and also former work for the Sunday Times Rich List. Yeah. I wonder what you make, Kevin, of the ability of people like the Duke of Buccleuch, I mentioned at the top of the hour, to squirrel his wealth away in tax havens.
Well, this I've constantly attacked this. He's not the only one. Most of the big landowners have their assets owned abroad. That's the essential position he's in. So when he sells them, he doesn't have to pay any tax. That's the purpose of that. And it's completely invidious. You know, Osborne tries to take $1 billion off the disabled and doesn't do anything to stop people like Buccleuch not paying tax on asset sales, which is what it's all about.
Richard?
Well, I agree entirely. This is just ludicrous that this it is possible to supposedly move land out of the UK by recording its ownership somewhere else, hide it in an offshore company, and then pay no tax as a result. It is just hideously offensive to me that somebody can believe that's appropriate, and that there are accountants and lawyers and bankers who are quite willing to be paid to do this. My friend Prem Sikka, a professor of accounting at Essex University, calls those people the pinstripe mafia, and I think there's some reason for that.
Now also, Richard, I think I'm right in saying on your blog earlier this year, you wrote something which really shocked me, which was looking at the Adam Smith Institute, almost implying that benefit claimants are some sort of somehow genetically inferior. I just wonder, you know, what it was about what the Adam Smith Institute said that made you think that.
I have to say you caught me by surprise there, because I can't remember the precise wording that they used. But they are basically, and this is part of a narrative that has been developed, it seems to me, very deliberately by some people, saying that those who are unable to find a job or have some form of disability that means they need support are somehow inferior. It was the language that, frankly, was used in the 1930s to imply otherness in Germany. They did it to the Jews, and they did it deliberately to create a group in society to hate. And I think a great deal of the narrative which has been created around the so-called benefits fraud, which is described as fraud when tax avoidance is described as something smart. You can see the difference in language again. You know, tax avoidance is done by the rich, so it's smart. Benefits fraud is done by the poor, so it's criminal, and pushes people apparently beyond the pale of society. All of this is designed to create this idea that these people don't matter, don't count, and should not be supported. I find that deeply offensive. I think most of the people who claim benefits in this country genuinely need support. Of course, there will be some people who abuse any system, but the vast majority of people who are on benefits are actually really struggling, and yet we have something like the Adam Smith Institute, which I'm afraid is considered to be respectable, using language which I believe implies that they think that the people who are making a claim are definitely inferior human beings. And to my sense of justice, that is utterly repugnant.
We were hearing earlier in our show, actually, that there are actually thousands, I think something like 8,000 people just here in Bristol who do not claim benefits that they're entitled to, and vast amounts of money as well that are left unclaimed. But look, Richard, if you can just sum up quickly, because we're nearly at the hour.
Yeah.
Really, we've gone quite well over, because it's so a fascinating conversation. Thanks very much. But whereabouts can people find your work and your book online, that sort of thing, and what's the title of your book?
I've written a number of books. The most recent is The Joy of Tax. The Joy of Tax is literally that it is the thing that can shape the society that we want. Nothing can do it more powerfully than our tax system. My work's easy to find online. Literally Google my name, Richard Murphy, and you will find my blog. I write on it several times a day. I'm continually putting up new ideas about how we can make, I believe, the world a better place by reforming our finance system, our economics, and our tax system. Richard Murphy, online. Easy to find.
So, yes, Richard Murphy, chartered accountant, tax avoidance pioneer, I suppose, actually pioneering to stopping tax avoidance. Thanks very much for joining us on The Politics Show.
Thank you.
And Kevin Cahill, I wonder if we could just talk to you briefly now before the news about latest developments with Safe Harbour and with data sharing that you've been involved with.
If it weren't printed by serious people, you would think you were reading Alice in Wonderland. The European Commission claims that the United States has given it assurances that they won't do mass surveillance again, i.e. PRISM. Well, when you read the assurances, they're not. They're actually assertions that the United States is going to go on doing mass surveillance.
And so
it's utter farce.
Is Britain. I mean, we've just had the, I think it's the second reading, it's nearly through now, the Snoopers Charter, which allows GCHQ up in Cheltenham to spy on not only on MPs, but on journalists and lawyers, so that they can actually swing court cases and kill stories in the news.
Tony, please. The people who have stolen 67% of the UK's people on the web's data are not GCHQ. I'm not defending them or anything. But it's the American internet giants. For 9 years, they've intercepted emails and they've stolen data, and they've gotten away with it too.
And now, I know on this show before, you've implied that you think that, that they may be just kind of a front operation for the National Security Agency, a giant data Hoover collecting agency.
Tony, it's official. It's court evidence. It's a judgment. They are. We can say absolutely that Microsoft...
So do the NSA pay these people,
yes,
like Twitter, etc., from how much?
The recent budget, I don't know, but they started paying 20 million a year to Microsoft.
Amazing. Anyway, time to sign off for the Murdoch News at 7. Up next, Mohamed Wakawi at the Colson Hall live. Thanks to our guests in the first hour, Green Councillor for Windmill Hill, Deborah Joffe. We're online at thisweek.org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for the politics show at 5 o'clock next week, and don't let those banksters get you down.
Live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 7, the Paris terror attack suspect Salah Abdeslam has reportedly, according to Belgian media, been wounded and captured in an operation in Brussels. A second man was also injured, and a third suspect holed up during the raid has now been caught, according to further reports in Belgium. Counter-terrorism expert...